20 seconds, but the protesters at the UN General Assembly went to Times Square with a big mural, "No Green Colonialism, Land Back Now." What are you hoping to see from the Biden administration?
Well, we want the Tamarack mine stopped, as well as the mine out in Nevada, Thacker Pass, but they're looking at trading our sacred Sandy Lake, where our people died by the hundreds. Our sacred lake for a Tesla mine. And we need to quit. What we need to do is reduce our consumption, get efficient, and not try to pretend that, you know, some new green colonialism is going to change things. There are many choices, like infrastructure for people, not for pipeline companies, and not for Elon Musk. And that's what we want. We want to protect the water. Thank you so much for taking a look at us in Minnesota, fifth of the world's water. It's worth protecting, and certainly we are not criminals.
Winona LaDuke, longtime Indigenous activist and author who lives and works on the White House.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland Police Accountability Commission will present its recommendations to City Council tomorrow.
Mayor Ted Wheeler considers seizing control of all city bureaus.
And PBOT wants to undo the parking-protected bike lane on Southwest Broadway.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 20th, 2023. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Reed Johnson. The Portland Police Accountability Commission, also known as the PAC, presents its final recommendations to the Portland City Council tomorrow. This marks a major milestone in the overhaul process that was set in motion by Portland voters in November 2020. The recommendations were unanimously approved by PAC members in their final meeting last month. They represent sweeping changes to nearly every part of the police accountability system in Portland. If the plan is implemented as proposed, the Independent Police Review, Citizen Review Committee, and Police Review Board will be replaced by two new interconnected bodies, a community-based oversight board and a city oversight bureau. Members of City Council, including Commissioners Maps, Gonzalez, and Mayor Wheeler, have expressed concern over draft versions of the plan. They've targeted two aspects of the proposal. The first is the oversight system's budget, which is pegged at 5% of the Portland Police Bureau budget. The second is the requirement that nobody associated with policing be allowed on the board or as an employee of the agency. But both of these pieces were part of the original 2020 ballot measure and are now baked into the city charter, requiring a considerable process to alter or eliminate them. Following the presentation tomorrow, the City Council will have to authorize the transition plan for work to begin on staffing the new board. The plan recommendations will also need to be approved by the Portland Police Association and Judge Simon, the federal judge who has been overseeing the city's implementation of the 2014 DOJ settlement agreements. A final council vote to implement these changes is not expected until summer of next year, and the transition plan does not see the system operating at full capacity until summer of 2025. Thursday's hearing is at 2 p.m. in person at City Hall and virtually on City Council's website. In other police-related news, Portland Police Chief Chuck Lovell has resigned. Bob Day will serve as interim police chief until 2025.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler is considering seizing control of all city bureaus from the other commissioners. It's one of the powers of the mayor to assign bureaus to other commissioners. A plan from his chief of staff put the timeline for this around 6 weeks, which has other commissioners alarmed. Seizing the bureaus would move the city closer to the major overhaul it must make by January of 2025, when the new government structure passed by voters comes into effect. It would also jumpstart the hiring of an interim city administrator, which will be an important position in the new government. Wheeler said, quote, "It's my intention to move to an interim city administrator as quickly as we can and consolidate the bureaus under that city administrator as quickly as possible," end quote. This comes as Wheeler has announced he won't run for a third term. Commissioners Renee Gonzalez, Mingus Maps, Carmen Rubio, and Dan Ryan released a statement on Tuesday objecting to the timeline of the seizure, saying that it should start in the latter half of 2024. City Council Chiefs of Staff also told Oregon Live that they were annoyed by the assumption that commissioners would simply cede their power, authority, and most essential functions of their job for the next 14 months.
Portland Bureau of Transportation Director Millicent Williams wants to undo the parking-protected bike lane on Southwest Broadway that was completed just last year. Williams emailed PBOT staffers with the decision, and insiders tell Bike Portland it was met with shock and disbelief. The bike lane between Northwest Hoyt and Southwest Salmon was completed in 2022, connecting two other segments on the High Crash Corridor. The Broadway bike lanes are now part of a plan for a network of protected bike lanes downtown, passed unanimously by City Council in 2018. The parking-separated model for bike lanes is one of the more popular designs PBOT employs across the city. The main gripes with the bike lane seem to come from businesses, especially hotels, who say it gets in their way for loading and unloading. PBOT is overseen by Commissioner Mingus Maps, and observers have said it's an odd move, especially since the department is facing such a serious budget shortfall. Since Bike Portland broke the story yesterday, PBOT and Maps have responded with statements. They say they've gotten quote-unquote mixed feedback on the new bike lane, and that they will be looking for public input in the coming months.
The Portland City Council is moving toward a new set of regulations for developers building in flood-prone areas, and environmental groups aren't happy about the proposals. For most construction, new buildings in the floodplain must be at least 2 feet above the base 100-year flood level. The sticking point for environmentalists is the longstanding exemption that allows developers along the south waterfront to ignore floodplain regulations that other developers must follow. Bob Salinger is the urban conservation director for Willamette Riverkeeper. Salinger said, quote, "There is no legal basis for exempting sites from these regulations, and doing so sets a bad precedent that will likely get repeated." Willamette Riverkeeper and 13 other conservation groups are suing the Federal Emergency Management Agency over its flood insurance program. They filed late last week, and they allege that FEMA's flood insurance program and floodplain development endangers salmon and other species. Commissioner Carmen Rubio is the head of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and made the decision to keep that exemption in Portland. This is despite her original campaign platform for council in 2020, which promised to advance the city's environmental goals. While Rubio is rumored to be planning to run for mayor next year, she says the issue isn't political. Rubio said, quote, "This is truly how do we meet the mission and intent of compliance for the good of our environment, and how do we also continue to make good on our goal about accelerating housing production," end quote.
A new book looks back at the first 50 years of Miss Magazine, the trailblazing publication that some say ignited the feminist revolution. Suzanne Potter spoke with executive editor Kathy Spiller to learn more.
This week, feminism passes a milestone of sorts as the iconic publication, Ms. Magazine, looks back on its first 50 years. A new book has just come out called 50 Years of Ms., the best of the pathfinding magazine that ignited a revolution. It features articles from each decade and traces the evolution of what was once known as the Women's Liberation Movement. Executive editor Kathy Spiller notes the first issue looked at the abortion controversy, a topic just as highly relevant today.
A year later, Roe versus Wade came down from the Supreme Court, and all of the mobilizing sense has resulted in one of the largest movements of this time, with the court now reversing Roe. Women are outraged, and we're watching their political power become even more decisive in election after election.
Other issues highlighted over the years include the role of working women, LGBTQ rights, the fair division of household labor, and Title IX, which led to a big expansion of women's sports. The magazine also exposed the harm caused by sexual harassment some 40 years before the Me Too movement. The U.S. is currently seeing a reactionary backlash to the progress made since the 1970s on gender and racial equality, with books being banned in school districts across the country and college programs on African American history and gender studies coming under attack in Florida. Spiller predicts the tactic will fail.
They can't put a genie back in the bottle. They can create a lot of damage, but they cannot stop the forward march of progress because too many women have seen the benefits of laws that prohibit discrimination and are simply not going to go back.
The magazine and its associated website and podcasts are now being published by the nonprofit Feminist Majority Foundation, with offices in Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek pulls $2.6 million in state dollars set aside for homeless response from Multnomah County because of the slow rollout. Kotek signed a $200 million funding package for homelessness response in March and set aside around $18 million for Multnomah County. The money was intended to get 1,200 Oregonians into housing and create 600 new shelter beds by next January statewide. Now Kotek is pulling $2.5 million of those funds from Multnomah County and redistributing it to six other counties. It'll be shared between Clackamas, Marion, Polk, Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook counties. Kotek first voiced concerns about the vagueness of Multnomah County's plans back in April. Even with the reduction in funds, Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson says it won't impact the county. Peterson told OPB, quote, "The governor and I both recognize that Multnomah County has more resources than other parts of the state. Our investments and goals and the impacts they will have on our homelessness response system and our ability to allocate targeted resources in this crisis will not change," end quote. Multnomah County has $40 million in unspent taxes to support homeless programs. That's part of the frustration felt by Portland City Council, who are considering severing ties with the Joint Office of Homeless Services over funding delays and disagreements.
A new Oregon law requires transparency from the Oregon Health and Science University in their Primate Research Center. House Bill 2904 requires OHSU to publish information each year on a public website. It must include the number of primates used in research, how many were bought or sold, the number used in breeding programs, as well as the number of animals who were, quote, injured or that died in a manner that resulted in a citation, end quote. The center has been in the news in recent years due to violations in animal deaths. In August 2020, a Primate Center employee accidentally placed two primates in a scalding cage washing machine. One was killed, and the other had to be euthanized. 2 years before, another primate had to be euthanized after getting tangled up in its cage. In total, there have been 31 Animal Welfare Act violations at the facility between 2014 and 2021. Alkashandra is with the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA. She said of OHSU, quote, "It's probably one of the worst, if not the worst, primate center in the U.S. in terms of violations of the Animal Welfare Act," end quote. An OHSU spokesperson said, quote, "We look forward to a time when non-animal research methods are capable of faithfully modeling the complexity of a living system," end quote.
Some GOP state election officials are pushing back against disinformation. President Biden urges the UN General Assembly to continue supporting Ukraine, and Pennsylvania celebrates National Voter Registration Day by enacting automatic motor voter registration. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
If you allow Ukraine to be carved up, is the independence of any nation secure? I'd respectfully suggest the answer is no.
President Joe Biden Tuesday implored world leaders at the UN General Assembly to stand firm against Russia's war in Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will meet with congressional leaders this week. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says he wants to hear Ukraine's plan for victory and better understand how U.S. taxpayer dollars sent there are being spent. David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation and Research says it takes courage to push back against election disinformation.
Once you capitulate to disinformation in one regard, you're going to feed that beast. That beast is not going away. It's going to get bigger and it's going to be coming for you.
So far, nine GOP-led states have withdrawn from ERIC, the state-run voter information sharing database that's a target of conspiracy theories. But others are sticking with it, including Georgia, where the Republican Secretary of State continues to get death threats. Tuesday was National Voter Registration Day. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro marked it by enacting what's known as a motor voter system.
This is a safe, secure, streamlined way to be able to get them to register and get them to participate in our democracy.
Pennsylvania is the 24th state to automatically register people when they get a driver's license. House Democrats marked the day by reintroducing the John Lewis Act. Representative Jim Clyburn of South Carolina says it rebuilds civil rights protections eroded by the U.S. Supreme Court. Clyburn cites the court returning to states with a history of voter suppression the power to change election laws without review by the Federal Department of Justice.
So this is not an issue that ought to just unify the members of this Congress. This should unify the people of this country.
Hunter Biden is suing the IRS, claiming two agents violated his privacy when they testified about his confidential tax information to Congress. IRS Supervisor Gary Shapley told a committee the president's son got preferential treatment.
There should not be a two-track justice system depending on who you are and who you're connected to.
Meanwhile, the House Republicans say they plan to subpoena Hunter Biden's bank records this week. In a sharp response, Democrats note this is coming when the government is just 10 days away from a shutdown. ABC News reports a longtime assistant to former President Donald Trump told federal investigators that Trump wrote to-do lists for her on the back of classified documents. When Trump later learned FBI agents wanted to interview the aide, he allegedly told her, "You don't know anything about the boxes." And the United Auto Workers Union is threatening to expand its strike unless it sees major progress in contract negotiations. UAW President Sean Fain says workers at more factories will join those who struck at three plants a week ago. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about his latest article detailing the city auditor's lobbying investigation of Zenith Energy. At 6 p.m., it's Earth Riot Radio. At 6:30, Free Culture Radio. And then at 7, Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with a low of 54 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, sunny, the high of 75. Today in history, in 1973, Billie Jean King beats Bobby Riggs in the Battle of the Sexes tennis match at the Houston Astrodome. And our quote of the day is from King, who said, quote, "Tennis is the perfect combination of violent action taking place in an atmosphere of total tranquility."
Women are underrepresented in the engineering field, and one Native student at Arizona State University is working to change that. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas from KMBA in Anchorage, Alaska, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. The percentage of female engineers varies by specialty, but 2021 figures show only 9% of mechanical engineers are women. A Native student at Arizona State University is working to change that, as Alex Gonzalez reports.
Claire Gunderson just started her first year at ASU studying mechanical engineering. She says her passion for this field started by helping her dad with his cars in her hometown of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And while she's disappointed to see a lack of diversity in the field, Gunderson says she's optimistic about the future.
I guess it's a little sad that, like, more women aren't involved in engineering, and it just inspires me to pursue what I want to do and make connections with everybody around me, no matter if they're male or female or whatever.
ASU awarded bachelor degrees in engineering to 460 women in 2021. Gunderson is also a National Indigenous Recognition Scholar. She graduated high school with top academic standing. Only 8% of ACT-tested American Indian and Alaska Native high school graduates meet college readiness and STEM benchmarks, according to the American Indian Science and Engineering Society. During her time at ASU, Gunderson says she hopes to become a member of the Formula SAE Club, which each year sets out to build a Formula-style race car to compete at an annual Formula student competition in Michigan. She says she's eager to see the process of building a prototype. For anyone considering the engineering field, Gunderson recommends taking time to explore your options and find the best fit.
If you're really into figuring stuff out and all that, like, bound to be something in engineering that you'll be able to find, whether it's like mechanical, electrical, the aerospace, anything like that. I think it's just really fun.
Gunderson and more than 144,000 other Sun Devils have begun their degree programs this fall at ASU campuses or online, the largest student enrollment in the university's history. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
The Michigan Bar Association's Representative Committee will grant its 2023 Unsung Heroes Award to the Nottawaseppi Huron Band of the Potawatomi Chief Tribal Court Judge, the Honorable Melissa L. Pope, on September 21st. According to the Michigan Bar Association, the Unsung Hero Award is presented to a lawyer who has exhibited the highest standards of practice and commitment for the benefit of others. September is Suicide Prevention Month, and new data shows that the suicide rate in the U.S. has increased dramatically over the past 20 years. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel reports, that's especially true for Native Americans and Alaska Natives.
The analysis was done by Pew Charitable Trusts. It found that from 2000 to 2020, the national suicide rate grew 30%. For Native American and Alaska Native women, the rate spiked more than 130%. For men, it jumped over 90%. Emily Edmonds-Harrows is with the Johns Hopkins Center for Indigenous Health. She says a major factor is the historical trauma caused by colonization and the boarding school era.
If a parent is traumatized because of these experiences and experiences those things and not allowed to talk about it, not allowed to cope with it, they then pass along that trauma to their children, and sort of this cycle perpetuates itself.
She says there's also a lack of funding for mental health care services in tribal communities. But efforts to bridge the gap are coming from the Indian Health Service, which is training tribal members to respond to people in crisis. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
If you or someone you know needs help, call or text the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. I'm Jill Freitas.
The White House announced the creation of the American Climate Corps today, modeled in part on the Civilian Conservation Corps that employed millions during the Great Depression. The new climate jobs training program could put 20,000 people to work in its first year. It would include projects like restoring land, improving resilience to natural disasters, and making clean energy available to communities. President Biden's climate policy advisor, Ali Zaidi, said, quote, "We're opening up pathways to good-paying careers, lifetimes of being involved in the work of making our communities more fair, more sustainable, more resilient," end quote. Most of the paid positions will not require previous experience. The Biden administration is proposing and making it easier for Climate Corps members to enter the federal public service after the program. While the New Deal Corps primarily employed young white men, that's not the intended demographic here. The White House says the American Climate Corps is designed to attract people from disadvantaged communities that are disproportionately impacted by the changing climate.
The U.S. has inventoried its forests after an executive order from President Biden, but so many could still be cut down for timber and other logging operations. In Virginia, environmental groups are finding there are other options the Forest Service can consider. Shantia Hudson reports.
Virginia environmental advocates are looking for protections for old-growth forest. In 2022, President Joe Biden issued an executive order to have old-growth forest across the country inventoried. A U.S. Forest Service report finds the agency is responsible for more than 24 million acres of old-growth forest. This amounts to only 4% of forest in the U.S. However, around 76% of these lands are unprotected from logging operations. Sam Evans with the Southern Environmental Law Center says the U.S. Forest Service needs to consider which forests should be cut and which shouldn't.
The responsibility there is for the Forest Service to figure out what's the healthiest mature forest, what mature forest is on the best track to restore that, and sort of leaving it alone, letting it age into old condition. Perhaps there are other mature forests that aren't in good condition, and maybe we can focus on those for timber cutting.
Environmental groups are reluctant to see these trees cut down since they help stave off climate change. Studies find old growth forests can store between 41 and 84% of the total carbon stock of all trees. Losing these trees represents a carbon equivalent to one quarter of the country's annual fossil fuel emissions. While forests are being planted in place of any old growth forest made into timber, Evan notes younger, even aged forests don't carry all the benefits of an old growth forest.
They really don't have a lot of diversity. They're just a lot of trees of the same age and a lot of shade on the ground. Those forests, those post-logging forests, don't have a huge biodiversity benefit.
He adds seeing this come to fruition will require cultural changes on the U.S. Forest Service's part to protect, conserve, and manage the national forest. This is Shantia Hudson for Virginia News Connection.
It's happening everywhere. 90% of U.S. counties had a weather disaster between 2011 and 2021. Dr. Anthony Leiswitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiswitz, and this is Climate Connections. Very few parts of the U.S. have been untouched by extreme weather. According to a recent report, 90% of U.S. counties had a federally declared weather disaster between 2011 and 2021.
Some counties have had as many as 12 disasters during that time.
That's Amy Chester of Rebuild by Design. Her group recently released the Atlas of Disaster, an online map of these events.
And the one thing that we found extraordinarily interesting is that no matter what state you look at, disasters are all over. It's not just a coastal issue in a coastal state.
In addition to the number of disasters in each county, the Atlas includes data on social vulnerability and energy reliability. And it shows the federal cost of weather disasters in each state, which in some places topped $1,000 per resident over a decade.
And why that's important is that we're able to show that we, as Americans, are all paying for this.
Climate change is expected to bring more extreme weather to many areas.
So we hope that people really dig in kind of deep into this report and start questioning what is our government doing right now and start getting involved.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
It's Wednesday, which means it's time for us to turn to KBOO News poet Dan Raphael, who wonders if equa-anything is an outmoded idea.
The equinox is coming. The equinox is coming. Who wants equal? We all want a little better, forgetting the math of closed systems where more for one is less for another. Having a new city government with 13 elected and 6 hired leaders is more people, more salaries, more confusion. 13 people making policy and only 6 making sure everything works. No equilibrium here, not enough concrete to support all that abstract. When the political pie is split between 2 parties and the largest third unaffiliated, while in both parties the few in charge are seldom in agreement with most of the rest, there's imbalance, confusion, entropy, as the 1% of the 1% tips all the scales in their favor. If the biggest issue facing our survival, the climate crisis and all its components, had even a fair share of political and media attention, I might feel the tunnel we're descending in will veer back toward the light soon enough to not be too late. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 20th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Sam Bauman, Jasmine Moneymaker, David Rosenberg, Phil Garfinkel, Chris Gao, and myself, Reed Johnson. The producer is my co-anchor, Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Edwin J. Vieira, Jill Freitas, Suzanne Potter, and the esteemed Dr. Anthony Leiswitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth. No.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots talking about his new article. It's called Portland Auditor Investigating Zenith for Lobbying Violations. Public records show Zenith and its PR firm engaged public officials consistently throughout 2022, but did not file lobbying reports. Welcome, Jeremiah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk through your new piece with us. So this follows reporting you did a few weeks ago, uncovering that Zenith Energy and its PR firm had been courting city officials before this surprise reversal on the land use compatibility statement. Can you give us just a little refresher on what you found in that piece?
Yeah, so despite the fact that city officials said that the land use compatibility statement, which will be referred to as the LUCS from here on out, despite city officials saying that that process was like any other process, our reporting a few weeks ago found through public records that there were significant communications between Zenith Energy, its PR firm, PacWest, and city officials and bureau staff within the city throughout 2022. That includes text messages, emails, Zoom meetings. It all kind of centers around this tour on July 29th, during which Zenith and PacWest appeared to convince city officials that Portland could be a renewable fuels hub of the future down at their facilities on the Willamette River.
So now the city auditor is investigating this as unreported lobbying activity. What constitutes lobbying in Portland? What has to be met if these reports haven't been filed?
City lobbying code basically says that in order to preserve the integrity of its decision-making process, lobbying entities that engage in efforts to influence city officials should report their those